All right, everybody. Welcome back to Mentioned in Dispatches. We've got a special edition today in that back from merry old England, Bob is with us again. Howdy, Bob.
Hello there, guys.
And joining us are the traveling duo of Musket Dudes, Jim and Doug. Jim, how are you today?
It's good. Happy morning. Good morning. There's the word. Good morning.
Yeah. Well, it's afternoon for Bob, and who knows when people are going to be listening to this.
Afternoon chops.
And Doug, who might end up actually getting official co-host duties on this podcast at this point, because he's kind of replaced Chris as our regular other guy. How you doing?
Hey, good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, we've noted on a podcast before, so it's not really a secret. Chris has been in the hospital, just had some injuries. It was not, you know, plague-related or anything. Seems to be doing a lot better. As we're recording this, got a call today that he's doing a lot better. I don't really have any details we're going to try and give out other than to say he's been in the hospital, because that's not a secret, and that he's getting better, which we don't want to be a secret. We want the improvement to be getting out there. So I don't know that we're going to hear Chris again this season of the podcast, but we're hoping everything comes back to normal and that we've got him back next season. We've got Doug and Jim and Bob on here, which is great because I got three folks that are all older than me. So I can just throw out a topic, let you guys ramble, and I don't have to do squat. One funny war story I'll tell quickly. Yeah, well, 6 feet, guys, 6 feet. When the very first Connections conference I ever went to was in Dayton, Ohio. This was probably about 10 years ago. And I was a panel co-chair. Matt Caffrey had tapped me to be one of the panel co-chairs. The other guys on the panel that year were an Army officer named Mike Martin, who was one of James Sterrett's students, and then Pete Bogdazarian, the game designer behind Tank on Tank and Dawn's Early Light and Toten Sontag. That was the panel that we had that year for what we were doing. And I kind of stopped in the middle of the panel, and a bunch of the folks that year, Connections, there was maybe 55, 60 of us. I mean, they get 200 people at Connections regularly now. That was the last year of like a small Connections. And a bunch of the folks in the room were folks that had been regulars at Origins at some of the war colleges and stuff over the years, that they knew me from panel moderating duties, but I've always been the kid brother in the room. Let's not kid ourselves that even when I was when I first hit north of the 40 line, I was still usually one of the younger war gamers in the room. And so when you've got a panel up there with Matt Caffrey and Chris Weave and John Tiller and Joe Miranda, like, I'm the kid brother. And I was cool with that. Like, I didn't have a problem with that. But I stopped in the middle of one of my presentations at Connections and kind of looked around, and a bunch of the folks, you know, again, Chris Weave and Eric Walters and these guys all knew me, and they kind of looked at me a little funny. I said, you know, I just realized this is the first time I've ever been on a wargaming panel where I'm the oldest dude on the panel. And this is a little weird for me. And a couple of them started cracking up. They're like, this is going to happen to you more. You realize that. This is coming. This is going to happen to you more and more. The joke continued into the next year, where the panel that Joe Miranda and I were co-chairs of a panel the following year. And we had Brian Train, we had Volko Runke, we had Roger Mason on the panel with us. There were five of us up there. And I made a quip about those of you that remember last year when I was the oldest guy on the panel and what an uncomfortable moment it was for me. I said, so this year I decided to overcorrect in the other direction. For whatever reason, Joe seemed really irked by that, but Roger kind of laughed it off. And Brian and Volko didn't have a clue what the joke was about because they had missed the comments from the year before, but it was good for a laugh for those that knew. So
you have to take your kicks where you can.
Kind of, yes. And folks that have been around any sort of panel discussion or presentation with me know that I have no problem with self-deprecating humor. There is plenty here to pick on, so you might as well get your money's worth. One of the recent, two actual threads that have gone on in the forums recently I thought might be fun ones to explore with you guys as wargamers of a certain age, but there's been a bunch of talk lately about a handful of the different old school early on computer wargaming, talking about being back on the Amigas, the old Commodores, the old C64s. I started on Macs in 1984 when there weren't any games, but building forward from there, and then
still
some
aren't.
Of the early.
Yeah, I was going to say. That,
yeah.
What changed? Yeah, just, look at this, 40 years on.
Yeah. Well,
you can all suck
it. One of the most enduring games that still takes a lot of beating is still Steel Panthers.
Yeah, so when did you start on Steel Panthers, Bob?
Well, I first got Steel Panthers 1 when it first came out, then 2 and 3, strangely. So I've actually played all the early ones, quite a long time. Then there was, I think it was Trap Games, and someone called SP Camo. They did another version of it as well, and introduced a lot more SP Camo Workshop. And they introduced a lot more features to it. But I still think that holds up really well for such an old game. It's like the original Combat Missions, the very first two, which were very amateurish, Combat Mission games were absolutely superb in terms of playability.
Yeah.
If you want to talk old school gaming, I still think Combat Mission Africa Corps is the best in that series. I enjoy X2. I just think they lost. I really believe that Stephen Charles lost the plot.
Yeah.
I care very much for them. I was a beta tester on Combat Mission X1, Beyond Overlord. It made my head explode. I thought it was so amazing. My father-in-law, God rest him, we played that by email for hours and hours and hours. He just loved it. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you say I actually did some uniform mods for it. I'm writing mods for it.
Oh, yeah.
The original Combat Missions was an absolute nightmare to do. But I can remember doing some because there was a guy who used to host mods for it. I can't remember who he's called now, a hosting site. And I did a stack. But then there was another guy, I think he was called Dark Knight. He was a Canadian mounted policeman. And he did a mod of all the markings and uniforms for 21st Army Group.
Yep. That mod is still in. If you go to Good Old Gamer, they include that mod among the pile of mods.
Fantastic.
That you get when you buy it. And if you go to Good Old Gamer, get it on sale. I think I paid $2.
Well, the guy actually sent it to me on, would have been CD-ROM at the time, because I spoke to him quite a bit, and he actually sent me copies of it, because at the time, I think I only had a dial-up connection.
Ouch.
And I said it would have taken me forever to have downloaded it. He said, give me your address and I'll send it, and he did. You know?
This is probably the first of 12 times, Brant, that we will say, when we were your age.
You guys aren't that much older than me. I mean, Bob, but
true.
The rest of y'all aren't.
The actual playability of those early Combat Mission games were just far and above anything else that anyone was doing in terms of computer war games.
Oh, yeah. The fact that the only game I would compare it to, if you want to go really, really deep, is to the original combat or Computer Ambush. Where you had one map. It was entirely ASCII characters, or in the case of the Commodore 64, actually it was that PETSCII that they had.
Yeah.
And the soldiers were letters.
Oh,
so you had the soldier D, who was Denny Dumke, and you had, you know, and it was Americans versus Germans, and you pre-plotted in a text script all their moves, and then watched as first the computer resolved it, and then it showed you what happened. Now, bear in mind, the resolution phase was nothing more than computer resolving turn, and then underneath it, screaming is heard, gunfire is heard. Screaming is heard. A grenade is thrown. And you had no idea what was happening. It was glorious Kriegspiel-y type stuff.
Sounds like your thing.
Yeah, I played that game so much that I was one day playing it, and I hooked it up in a crude, kitbashy way. Once again, second time, you kids will never understand what it was like to try to hook up a computer to a TV. you know, the slide, I think there's even a meme of, remember that RF switch that you had to have?
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, that's actually a meme. If you know, if you know what this is, you are of a certain age. And
like an RSR, was it 232 interface?
RS-232 interface, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, my father, who knew nothing of computers, but is still a ninja with a soldering gun. He actually helped me solder an RS-232 cable between my Amigas to turn it into a dummy modem.
There you go.
Once again, third time, you kids will never understand. If you've gone after your computer gear with a soldering gun, you are of an age.
Look, there's a certain age at this point that doesn't understand using cables to get data in and out of computers.
No, that's true, yeah.
And so cordless computers have become the new cordless phones. Like, they don't remember phones with cords on them. Never mind computers that needed Ethernet cables to do anything. Yeah. So,
never, never,
again,
mind, never mind phones that were attached to the wall by a cable.
Yeah, exactly. Or dial-up modems or anything. I mean, the wireless free existence these folks live, where you can just grab the computer, the phone, the tablet, and wander around the house is so off the wall to many of them.
Yeah, to Bob's point about RS-232 ribbon cables, where each one of those was an eminently breakable little wire. Yep. You know, we want none of that. So I had hooked my 64 up to a television, and I played this game so much, and my buddy, my best friend, he came over, and he would sit down, and we would put in the moves, and we would plot it. We played it so much, he said to me, and I remember it like it was yesterday, we had stolen beer from somewhere, because we were nowhere near old enough to drink, sitting around playing this game, and he goes, "Do you smell something funny?"
Yeah. Something that smells like kind of ozone.
Yeah. Yeah, almost exactly. My Commodore 64 had melted. I killed it. I killed my Commodore 64 playing this game. So Combat Mission Beyond Overlord was the spiritual successor, and so I fell passionately in love. And I mean this very sincerely. If you still want, in some ways, the best 3D WeGo World War II tactical game, it's still Combat Mission Africa Corps.
Yes, it was. It was unfortunately, that was the last of the ones before Battlefront really started messing about. Because if you think, certainly the first Combat Missions was a game produced by amateur wargamers for wargamers. It was not by any really a commercial thing at all. You know, it was very much an amateur production.
Yep. Yeah, if we start getting off onto the tangent of things Battlefront has done to Combat Mission, this is going to be a five-hour episode, and we're going to be up past Bob's bedtime. So.
But no, I think if you're talking about classic games, there is absolutely no reason. And back to Steel Panthers, I think the one thing I remember about that is it passed through so many hands. You know, I had the first one, I had the second one, but I will say this, I've got a buddy who plays three computer games. He's a little older than I am. He plays three games. He adores World of Tanks, which is fine. He plays Master of Orion 2, and he plays Steel Panther. Yeah. That's it. He has said, when they surpass Steel Panthers, in my judgment, I will give it up. And he tries all the new games at that scale and at the level. He just won't walk away from them. So honestly, it's design. There is UI, there is game design that just really hasn't been surpassed for those people that love it.
Doug, where was your entry point to computer wargaming?
Oh, gosh. I distinctly remember.
I'm saying Abacus doesn't count.
Yeah, no. I had a game that was a Cold War gone hot, operational level game played on the Apple II. And I'll be damned if I can remember the name of it. But, you know, definitely ASCII graphics. And this would have been back about 1986, 87, was quite probably my first genuine computer game.
Yeah.
Came on a 5 1/4 floppy, and I distinctly remember playing it when I worked for a Catholic boarding school for Native American kids in Chamberlain, South Dakota. And I was the recreation director. And during the day, I'd have to go over to my office because I'd have meetings, but, you know, the kids were in school, so I didn't have a lot to do. So I'd sit around in the rec center in my office all day long playing this game for hours and hours. A lot of the same stuff that Jim and Bob are talking about, you know, is kind of where I ended up going with some of that stuff. Certainly Steel Panthers, particularly in the very early days of Steel Panthers. Trying to remember, it seemed like there was a game. It may just have been Steel Panthers. Yeah, first released in 95, so that probably was, again, one of my early ones from SSI.
I just was looking up while you were talking. Is it Reforger 88?
It may be.
Which is another SSI game from 84.
might have been.
Like yeah. M1 Tank Platoon from Microprose was a...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you see, you guys are talking about, you know, Steel Panthers and you know, released in 95. I was thinking back to the 80s because that's where a bunch of the game discussion in the forums had gone on in terms of what to play back then. You know, you guys like to make fun of the fact that the Mac didn't have a ton of game stuff on it. And you're right, it still doesn't have near as much as others, but it still, you know, I had enough to stay entertained. The one that drove me nuts was trying to play Balance of Power back in the mid-80s. Like, the best you're ever going to get is to flip one sub-Saharan African country from leaning slightly Soviet to leaning slightly American. And, like, any time you could flip a second country to leaning slightly to the West without the nukes flying, you were like, yes, I've done something good with this game. And that was the best you were ever going to get out of it.
I very nearly lost a friend to Balance of Power.
I hated that game.
I did, too. I did, too. I said, this is such a bollocks sim that favors the Soviets in every respect.
Yeah. And I say hate it in past tense. I still hate it. I just haven't played it in 35 years.
Yeah, no, are you kidding? I've still got it on my machine running in a DOS box.
Really?
Just because I one day will write a paper about how history has crapped all over this design. you know, and it's just why it was just historically wrong. It was rubbish. It was now, on the other hand, I've had this discussion actually with Bruce Garrick. In some respects, it is an early instance of game design as polemic, as argument.
Yeah,
right.
It is making a very, you know, games like Reforger, which I don't remember, although I'm looking at these graphics going, oh, yes, that was SSI back then.
Right.
Yeah.
That was, and you know what? We loved this because we could actually see units instead of text. Anyway.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, let's not, you know, but I've made the point. I said, if the point of a game is to make an argument, and I don't mean that in the sense of creating a fight. I mean in saying making a point, putting forth a point. Boy, you couldn't give a better earlier example in my mind than Balance of Power.
Well, and what made Balance of Power so much more fun for me is about the time Balance of Power came out, my dad had just completed a master's degree in Soviet studies through Georgetown, was a U.S. Army foreign area officer specializing in Eastern Europe. He had finished 18 months of language school learning Russian and spent about 3 months on the embassy supply run ferrying building supplies from Helsinki to Moscow when we were building the new embassy in Moscow and doing it all under a black diplomatic passport. So I had in my house, I had an American who had as much time as, you know, 99.99% of the U.S. population in and around the then Soviet Union as you were going to find. Like there weren't any other Americans that had that level of access to the Soviet Union that you were just going to be able to, you know, sort of catch them walking by the office. Again, had to walk by the office because the computer had to stay plugged into the wall. Hey, Dad, come here. Take a look at this. What the heck? Yeah, that's totally wrong. Okay, just wanted to make sure that... So I had a subject matter expert in the house that I could very easily flag down and go, what the hell? And somewhere, not always hell, and somewhere in there after being admonished for my language, he would look at it and go, yeah, that's screwed up. Don't worry about that. Well, but Dad, I need to win the game. You know, there was no ability to win that game. It just wasn't going to happen.
I tell you, there was another point where computer games went from being text only, which were predominantly, I suppose, adventure games and fantasy games, to you suddenly get such as the Spectre 6, where suddenly you have graphics. And that puts a whole different aspect on the type of game that was being produced. One of the early ones I can remember as well was a very early Barbarossa game that was done by Matrix Games, if I remember rightly. And it was a freebie. And it was operational. The graphics, again, weren't up to much, but you had units which were recognised as, you know, being war games counters with NATO symbol in it, where you could actually click on a division and you could alter the composition and you could do all sorts of things to the game. And that was probably one of the first big operational what I would call a proper war game on a computer.
I remember being impressed with the static window graphics on the Bard's Tale games on the C64s that it was basically a text adventure, but you'd have that static graphic up there, whether you were walking through town or a troll jumped in front of you or whatever it was. I'm like, hey, that's kind of cool.
Yeah,
but they were all static graphics. They were not graphics in motion. It was, here's the picture of what you're looking at, and then off you go.
There used to be a First World War, not computer game, but I can't remember what it was called now, but it was a book. And when you took an action, it told you to turn to page so-and-so.
If
anybody ever remembers playing Ace of Aces or something like that, was it called?
Yeah. Well, there were the Choose Your Own Adventure books, but in England you had the Fighting Fantasy game books from Livingston and Jackson.
Yeah, but remember those.
Bob's talking about Nova Games Ace of Aces.
Yeah.
Oh, those.
And it's the flip books.
Yeah.
And it was, and which also they did a Dragon Riders of Pern version. And actually, Nova Games actually rebooted that whole franchise. And a couple Origins ago, I picked up the new version. It was quite lovely, actually. They did a nice leatherette bound. That was the big premise, that they were leatherette bound for many years at the Renaissance Fair. And then West End Games licensed the mechanism and did a Star Wars X-Wing versus TIE Fighter version of that. I still have that one in a very battered state, because we took it down to the Renaissance Fair when I was performing there, and we would sit backstage during breaks and play that for hours on end. I would not be me if I didn't say that I think of that generation that we're talking about, the middle to late 80s, the greatest game for me, probably still Computer Ambush, just because of how much I played it and loved it. A hot number two is the absolutely seminal by David Landry, Battles of Napoleon by SSI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How are we not surprised that there would be a Napoleonic game in there that you would love?
I can't really say that I'm shocked by that statement, Jim.
That's all right. It was one of those games that, to be honest, made me really frustrated when Age of Rifles came out, which most people point to from that generation as the best. And I said, I love Age of Rifles, but it doesn't have muskets in it.
Right.
It says so in the title, so I don't like it as much. And one of the things that most people don't know is that Landry eventually got permission from SSI to release expansion packs that you bought on three and a half inch discs.
Oh, yeah.
And he released scenario discs, including, interestingly enough, not just your Leipzigs, Quatre Bras, Osborne Esslings, but he also did an entire one of, he did what? I got my sheet right here. Camden, Cowpens, King's Mountain, Hobkirk, and
I remember these.
Yeah, and Utah Springs, as well as the Battle of New Orleans and some others. So he did both of those in an engine, and this, by the way, has been rated as one of the top 100 computer games of all time. I think it is one of the very, very few, and maybe one of the last. I was thinking about this. Didn't know we'd be talking about this, but I was thinking about this question. When you look at Napoleonic computer games, how many of them, because of where they were generationally? Total Scourge of War Waterloo is a wonderful game. I love it. I've played it a lot. Doug and I have played it together. But the problem is, it exists now in our cul-de-sac. Battles of Napoleon entered the, such as it was, the broad computer mainstream among us nerds in the late 80s. It was part of the blend. And I think, where was the time I saw it? Yeah, it actually sold something like 10,000 copies.
Yeah.
Which
was some going then.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, before, you know, this is the sixth time. You kids will never understand. The idea of selling a million computer games was absurd.
Yeah.
There were a million computers.
Right.
That's like when Atari made more copies of the E.T. game than they had sold consoles.
Right, right. And so, you know, and so to for this the last of my games, the Napoleonic games, to enter the broad mainstream, and so it always has a very special place. I still have it. I run it. It's not, I'm not going to compare it to the Tiller games now, which are obviously infinitely better, and Scourge of War and all that stuff, but it's still... It was the stuff. Oh, Austerlitz, how I love it.
Yeah, 10,000 games, 10,000 copies at this point is, you know, Call of Duty on a Tuesday afternoon 6 years after it was released.
On a Steam sale. Yeah.
Or something to that effect. So.
Yeah, but the games then had a much longer lifespan. I mean, now, if you look on Steam, you see games and, you know, they come out for 40 quid or whatever, and then 2 weeks later they're in sale for, you know, a quarter of the price, whatever. You know, there isn't a longevity of a lot of games now, because it's a bit like, I suppose, Counter and Hex War games. There's so many of them coming out, you can't possibly keep up with. Oh, God knows, I know some of my friends do try. You can't keep up with.
If it involves a short Corsican, Jim's trying.
I will try.
I'm not pointing the finger at anyone here. You know.
but we will. It's okay.
I think, honestly, one of the things that we're kind of talking about here is what made a lot of those games great, despite the fact that they had, in some cases, as Jim was just talking about, literally non-existent graphics, right? You know, you just talked about Sniper literally not having graphics. Despite that, the depth of the gameplay and the mechanisms were very, very appealing to us all. And I think a lot of newer games, the depth of the gameplay is in, you know, in reality, pretty shallow. You know, this is one of my arguments with people who come back and go, oh, Tiller's made the same game for the last 20 years. Well, yeah, because it works.
Yeah.
Right? The engine actually works, and there's a great deal of depth in that gameplay. Now, it's also not a true argument because he's tweaked the hell out of that engine, and you can see that, but despite that, right, and despite the fact that Tiller graphics are often not that great, you get a lot of depth in the gameplay, and I think that there's a big difference. You guys kind of hit on it, right, that the early combat mission games were developed by gamers, war gamers for war gamers, and we see this, you know, in the takeover of Matrix / Slytherin, where it's no secret that those guys are going for a larger, more mainstream audience than they've had in the past, and so they're starting to publish games that probably aren't as deep, aren't as significant, don't have the simulation fidelity, are easier to play, because they're going for a broader audience. You know, and I can't fault them for the commercial imperative. They're running a business. They got to make money. But at the same time, it's harder and harder to find computer games that have the sort of depth. And I personally think it's one of the big reasons that I have switched. I play fewer and fewer and fewer war games on the computer.
No, same here, Doug.
I've gone really more towards board games and then, you know, what we've been doing with Tabletop Simulator, which, yeah, we're using a computer game to facilitate it, but in no way, shape, or form can what we're doing with Tabletop Simulator be construed as a computer game.
You know, again, the academic pedantism of it all, folks know that, you know, I sometimes bring too much of that into the discussions, and that's fine. But as you're trying to sort of thinly slice those things for the people that care about such distinctions, Tabletop Simulator, anybody trying to say Tabletop Simulator is a computer game is full of crap. It's a computer-mediated way to play something. The computer is a necessary, you know, transmission component.
Right.
But it's real-time play-by-mail. It's really what this is.
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, Vassal, to a certain extent, would fill the same bill.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's an interface for people who can't sit around a table. For all intents and purposes, especially if you're using chat the way we are now, either through Steam or Discord or whatever, for all intents and purposes, you're playing someone who's at the other side of a table. In a lot of respects now, especially with the world situation as it is, probably gamers have got an edge over a lot of other people because we are used to finding entertainment in that way. We're not sort of sitting thinking, well, there's nothing to watch on TV or, you know, watch all these DVDs. We're used to being able to play in a sort of remote way. You know, Doug and I have played stuff on Vassal and whatever. The fact that we're 4,000 miles away from each other makes absolutely really no difference. But we've already opened those channels. We're used to playing Vassal or a Tabletop Simulator with someone who's not physically there. And so, in a way, we've got an edge over people now who are looking around for forms of entertainment.
Yeah, but absolutely.
We're all right, so sod you.
Well, I was making the comment before we went live that there's a lot of folks now that are coming on to Vassal, to be sure, but also Tabletop Simulator is going
exploded.
Nuts.
No, it's
crazy because I've crossed over 1,000 hours on Tabletop Simulator. I go to the workshop just about every day to relax and see what people have created. I used to be able to go through a page of stuff and that would be it. Now there are pages of new things. And the really cool thing is we're starting to see people actually start to model. We have even seen pikemen, 30 years war pikemans. The same guy who did my Bavarians that I love so much. Yes, they're mine. That's right. The same guy who did my Bavarians is working on Pikeman because, well, I asked him. And I actually, he's doing it because we mentioned it on a Saturday Night Fight. So that was one of the big lacks. And so he's going in there. But if you go to the Tabletop Simulator, and what the other thing you're seeing, and it goes right to the topic we're on, you will see so many people building old war games.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Going, oh, wait. I have this old SPI game in my collection, and I can figure out a way to work. Oh, I get it. And I'm telling you, there are games that SPI that are showing up that I didn't know SPI did, and I thought I had them all, much less knew them all. It's crazy. It's crazy and very, very cool. These systems hold up. People like them. People play them. And I, again, I'll say it, design will out. Design will always come through.
Yeah. And it's the fact that people are now prepared to put the effort in, like you do, Jim, to produce stuff from components, or even to design components. And the fact that people now, such a lot of people, have got the ability to use the tools that can produce parts that other people can then take and build modules for the game. You know, and that's a wonderful thing, really, when you think about it.
Well, I think the graphics tools have gotten simple enough that the barrier to entry there is low enough for many people to actually create their own stuff, or not necessarily create their own, but modify an existing. The graphic tools are simple enough that you can go to BGG, get a scan of a counter sheet, slice it up pretty easily, use those components. Not saying that's like, you know, kosher in terms of all copyright law and everything else. I don't want to start making legal distinctions where I shouldn't, but the tools are there that technically you could do that if you want to. So.
Sure.
You know. Well, but, you know, and we had a long discussion on the Tabletop Simulator Games Group about copyright, and this is, you know, the answer I've given people is, why do you think I usually do miniatures? It's like, you know, I've got the rules. I don't put the rules for Blücher on the table. I put the quick reference charts on there.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, if you want to play Blücher, you go get Sam's rules.
Right,
you know?
Go buy that stuff. And you
go buy that stuff. It's freaking $10 or $20, whatever it is. And it's worth 30 times that, in my judgment. You know, go out there and pay the man. So from a miniatures perspective, there's no copyright issues there, right? And on the other hand, what's fascinating, I know this isn't a TTS discussion, but I found this conversation really interesting. There are some companies that will murder you if they catch you doing their stuff on TTS.
Yep.
I'm looking at you, Steve Jackson. I'm looking at Games Workshop. And it's gone to the point that people have come up with clever naming conventions to hide Warhammer stuff from search engines. We use code words. You know, we speak
Ham Warrior.
Whereas other companies, friend of Armchair Dragoons, Jack Thompson, Dr. Jack Thompson, DJack, he loves it. He puts his stuff out there in very nice formats. Undaunted is out there. His beta test of By Stealth and Z is out there. We did a video, Velker and I did it, we played it. So there are some, and Cole Worley. His brilliant Pax Pamir 2, one of my favorite games that isn't a strict war game, as well as his John Company, are both available from him.
Yeah.
So they don't see it as, and I, let me be clear, I own both those games. This just gives me a way to play it with my friends. So that, I think that's a fascinating part of what's happening too. But no, we are returning to old games, and the really cool thing is because tabletop, like Vance and I, just on a lark last Friday, got together and played a game of Jena Auerstadt where he punched my face in. And people jumped online and said, hey, what is this? This looks great. And I said, it's a game from 1978. And people discovered a good, straightforward, simple war game that looked nice. Is it gorgeous? Of course not, but it looks nice. Mad Mark, love you, Mad Mark, redid all the counters so they're real clean. Great aesthetic, and now they discovered a simple game they could play with their friends, which to me is the whole point in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've talked some tabletop simulators. I mean, look, we did a whole episode on Tabletop Simulator. We've talked some in the past about it. Now that, you know, thanks to the plague locking everybody in, we've gone from just Saturday Night Fights to Wednesday Night Warfare and Thursday Night Throwdowns and whatever other alliterative names you're coming up with. Bob, I don't know that you were watching live, but you watched the replay of the monsters trying to take down Jim's town, no?
Yeah, I did watch it. Unfortunately, I've only ever been able to catch one game when it was being played. Again, the time difference. But I always go on and watch after the event. And it just really, it's such an entertaining thing to watch and to listen to the dialogue and, you know, read the comments that people put. So to me, I found that it's more than just the game itself. It's the whole social thing that is built around the game as well. And that makes it so very, very entertaining.
Yeah. Doug, you were one of the first Saturday Night Fights opponents before even Tabletop Simulator. You guys were doing like a Tiller game for one of your live streams long, long ago.
Tiller and some other stuff. And, you know, I think that, and certainly you see this in the genres, right? I mean, there's the whole Twitch streaming and, you know, my son is constantly streaming, playing, you know, a variety of MMO kind of games and shooters and things like that. There's a whole new recreational activity that didn't exist 5-10 years ago of people playing games online, which I think is a phenomenal thing, and I think it's really revitalized or added to the growth of gaming as a legitimate activity. What I think Tabletop Simulator has been phenomenal or is providing that same sort of capability to board gaming, whether that's by adapting game to, you know, its environment or encouraging us to do things like sharing a Tiller game. Because, you know, let's face it, Tiller games are computer adaptations.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's another thing that people never have really understood about Tiller when they gripe about Tiller is, you know, playing Tiller against the AI is nothing that was ever intended. It's at best a practice kind of thing. Tiller games are board games, and he had to write his own engine because something like Tabletop Simulator didn't exist.
Yep, totally.
So, you know, what we did with that and its eventual growth into Tabletop Simulator is really something that I think our hobby's been trying to do for 30 years.
It's just evolved, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. We have better tools. We're doing the same thing everybody else is doing. We're leveraging the better tools to play the things that we want to play against other people.
But you know what's awesome? What we're seeing is the increasing marginalization of those that lift up their nose and say that's not real gaming of a type. I'm speaking particularly of my miniatures, brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. I've painted the miniatures. I've got poly-S acrylics under my fingernails to this day. So don't even come over here with that. I've spent more on 001 brushes than as much as anyone. I realize some have probably spent more. But, you know, these days, at this point in my life, this is so spectacularly awesome. I'm still playing miniatures games. I'm playing Blücher, and I've played 5 battles in Blücher that I would have never. I mean, come on! How many times were we going to get together and play Ekmul?
Right.
Right. Well, what's that going to happen? But
4 more than necessary.
Tonight we're going to finish a 9-hour battle of Friedland.
No, you're not. No, you're not. There's not a chance in hell you guys finish tonight.
Oh, that sounds like a wager. But the reality is, we're the next. Well, it won't be the next game because we actually have the anniversary of Ekmul coming up. I think it's Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. So it's Jerry Day. I'll explain that later. But it's Jerry Day, and so I have to play Ekmul sometime this week. But you know, we're going to be playing Vagram for Blücher. With seven command, you know? When were we going to do that face-to-face?
Never.
Conventions?
The 12th of never. And so, for me, for these guys in some of these groups, and they're guys, well, you're not actually miniatures gamers, are you? Like, stop it. Stop that.
So, here's what I would argue, though. You're more the miniatures gamer than they are. They are the miniatures arts and crafts. And I think you made this point online. There's a certain segment of the miniatures community for which it is a painting club with loosely associated rules that belongs more in arts and crafts class, right? It's the male equivalent of Pino's palette. And then there are the gamers. The likelihood of a gamer showing up with an unpainted army and actually showing his face in public, slim to none. But that doesn't mean, look, there's a reason the army painter process even exists that you can dunk your minis through three different quick coats of paint, shake them off, and put them on the table and go. It's because you want to play the game. You don't want to, you don't want arts and crafts class. Again, going back to some of that research we did 15 years ago, like, there's statistical evidence to back up the fact that a non-trivial portion of the minis wargaming community, the guys who list minis wargaming as their favorite type of game, are primarily motivated by the arts and crafts aspect of it, not the game aspect of it. Like, I've got the factor analysis to show that, and I don't think it's changed that much in 15 years.
No, I suspect you're right. I mean, one of the things we used to like was we started off, Doug and I, playing on Vassal with hold the line first, wasn't it, Doug?
Yep.
And then on to Horse and Musket. We always used to be able to say, well, look at that. We just played a complete scenario to a conclusion in an evening or, you know, an afternoon, whichever. And we come out and we felt the results of the game felt good. They felt historical. And we think, how often could you actually do that with a game? You could sit and say, well, we're going to finish this in one sitting.
Yeah. At a convention, you know, maybe, but not much else. Certainly not with certainly not with an ocean in between you.
Right.
And Doug always used to win.
Ooh, we used the past tense. Nice.
Well, it's because we haven't played for a bit. He knows the rules better than
that's it. But you know, to your point, Bob, it's one of the things that's going on. I mean, look, what ultimately was Volley and Bayonet, the rule set that becomes Grand Armée, the rule set that becomes it. It was a response to, in my judgment, Napoleon's Battles, Empire, even to a lesser extent, Shaco, although Artie was headed down a particular road. It was a response to, can we finish a game? And it goes to the rule that I've shared on this podcast before, and I think it always applies. Watch a game, walk away from the game, come back in an hour. Has it changed? If the game state hasn't changed, it's probably not the best.
So,
gamers generally have been pressing. I mean, there's one of the guys that's over on your side of the Atlantic, Bob, the Storm of Steel Wargaming. He is doing a wonderful job posting his solo games because he's locked down like you. And he is right now live tweeting the Battle of Waterloo for Blücher.
All right.
6mm. Having a blast, putting up the pictures, and he's going to finish by himself Waterloo today. And it looks like Waterloo, it plays like Waterloo, and to me, that ties directly back to the game that Vance and I played last week, which again was Jena Auerstadt. We got in a full battle of Jena Auerstadt, satisfying conclusion, interesting strategic discussions, 2.5 hours.
Brilliant.
That's not crazy. And while I will always, look, again, I'm setting up the Battle of Wagram, which will not play in 2.5 hours. But, you know, we are driving for that. We want that. And when we talk about classic game design, if we have forgotten, not too many of them were these slogfests.
Right.
Yeah.
The battles and battles of Napoleon were not long. The battles in Combat Mission First Edition were not long.
No, sure.
You know, they were digestible in a human lifespan. And I wish I got to ask Captain Darwin, Jim Snyder, because he gave me the absolute funniest analogy for this. I want to write it down and always use it. But what I've always said is we have this tendency with our games to go, well, this moderately sized game was incredibly fun.
Yeah.
Now let's make it 12 times bigger and it'll be 12 times better.
But it never is.
It never
is. No.
It just never is. And I'm glad to see that with Horse and Musket, which I do have to build some more mods for, with Blücher, with all these other games we're playing, that people are realizing that, hey, those older games, those computer games that we loved when we were younger, they actually had some common sense to them and a manageability and a digestibility that deserves imitation.
Jim, you keep talking about walking away and seeing the same game state an hour later. Your membership in the OCS fan club is going to get revoked. You know that, right?
And you know what? And let me be perfectly clear. That's a reference nobody's going to get. Let me be perfectly clear. If that is your jam, or I'll put it on my horse, if you want to play Love a Tie, you must do that. That's what you should do. Or if you want to go onto Tabletop Simulator and take Mad Markup on Napoleon at Wellington's Victory, the gigantic SBI monster game of the Battle of Waterloo, if you want to do that, please never don't, okay? Doug and I will be over here playing Tiller's Waterloo. Let's see who gets there first.
Yes. Yeah, that was a big game. I remember it only too well. And there was also an S&T spin-off, which was Cabra, using the same system.
You mean Nay versus Wellington? That's what they called it over here anyway.
Somewhat like the paint the miniatures guys. Some of these more complex games, right? I mean, I own a number of the Battles from the Age of Reason, which are the, you know, equivalent to Labatai.
Yes.
I really never play those games, but I do study those games.
Ah.
And there's value in that as well. Just like, you know, if your gig is painting miniatures, that's great. That's a wonderful hobby, okay? But look, we don't have to turn around and go, well, if you don't enjoy playing OCS or you don't enjoy playing Labatai, you're not a real war gamer.
Yeah.
You know what? If I'm playing frickin' Ogre, I'm a war gamer.
Yep.
Okay?
But if you're playing Coin, you're not.
Well, no. Now you're a Euro.
Twilight Struggle! Twilight Struggle!
Now you're a Euro guy.
That's right. You are six inches from wheat growing.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
That's going to make a wonderful sig line for somebody.
You can see Anxiotic Wheat Orgy from here.
That's
I am so designing a game called Hanseatic Wheat Orgy just for Doug. I'll make it a free download so nobody has to spend money on it.
You just sold three copies already?
I was going to say, we want it on our shelf. If not, you know what? You don't even have to design that game. Just design that box.
Yeah.
That's right. That's all you really need.
Just aside from my buddy Doug, I was at the gym.
Wait a minute. Didn't the Navy already design Hanseatic Wheat Orgy?
Yeah, they did.
That was this week's podcast. We've covered that.
But no, I just to Doug, just a brief aside, because I thought of Doug. I was at the gym and I was listening to Tom Vassell do one of his things, and they got around to, and they brought a new guy on, a new guy by the name of Jeremy, who is so good, and he's like my voice on the Dice Tower now, and
okay.
I hope he stays. And he came on, and Tom announced that his favorite game of all time was Le Havre. Is right now his number one is Le Havre. And Jeremy just looked at him and went, first of all, there was this silent stare.
Yeah.
And secondly, it was, what's that game about exactly? It's wheat, isn't it? It's about moving large quantities of wheat.
Right.
You have told your hundreds of thousands of viewers that the greatest game of all time involves the movement of wheat.
Of wheat.
And I went, yes, preach, preach.
That's my guy.
That's my dude. So, sorry to interrupt. I forgot to.
So, Doug, you were talking about the big ones in your collection that you actually spend a little more time studying versus playing. I think part of that probably ties back into what you'd mentioned on the Horse and Musket podcast about that development work being maybe as close as you're going to get to academia. In what you're able to do with your life at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a thing about me and games. I, you know, my signature on the forum says, it turns out I really don't like games. and there's, that's said a little bit tongue in cheek, but to me, games tend to be a means to an end, at least war games. I play war games because I'm deeply interested in the history. And that's why I tend to not play games for periods that I'm not interested in, or at least currently not interested in. You know, I haven't played a World War II game, and I can't tell you how long, because I'm just not interested in it anymore.
Probably the last time we had you do them at a convention.
Yeah, probably. That's probably about it, right? But, you know, you can pick the most minute. You know, I have a game about the War of Jenkins' Ear, and I've played it. Now, the people listening, I'll bet there's not 1% of the people listening to this podcast who are already a pretty self-selected group who have any freaking idea what the War of Jenkins is.
true story. I know more about the controversy about that game than I do about the War of Jenkins here itself.
I was about to say, I wouldn't necessarily rule that out, but Jim has drawn an important distinction there. I think there are a bunch of us that remember the throwdown over it that don't necessarily remember the specifics of the war.
Yeah. Right, right. Exactly. And, you know, so I'm interested in, I do it because I'm interested in the history. And sometimes that means I'll buy a game that I'm probably not really going to play, or not play to its conclusion, or not play with another person, just because I want to examine the mechanics of the game to understand how, you know, why something really happened, right? I mean, give me an understanding of the history, and the mechanics of the history.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm playing it for a very different reason, which, you know, I give the coin guys a lot of shit, but really it's because, from what I've seen, the mechanisms of that game don't really appeal to the periods that I'm interested in. It isn't that they're bad games. They're not bad games.
It's no, just, of course not.
You know, they just don't really, it's not my thing.
Yeah,
but we've had a conversation in the past, though, haven't we, Doug, about we're not really worried who wins or loses a game, because we're not playing it to say, well, I won. We're playing to see, to examine a historical situation of what happened in the particular battle or whatever. And so we're looking at it as a historical tool rather than a competitive event.
Yeah, that's completely the case. I mean, I don't think you can ever completely be like, hey, I'm uninterested in winning. Everybody kind of likes to win.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Not the be-all and end-all.
Right, but it makes it a hell of a lot easier for it to be a friendly competition when you're just not that invested in it, right? I'm a lot more invested in understanding how things worked and why people did the things they did, which,
yeah.
You know, to me is the really fascinating thing about the history is, why did we do the things that we did? And,
yeah,
you know, we read about it or we see it represented particularly via Hollywood and we go, wow, that was an incredibly dumb thing for that person to do. But we're interpreting it through a modern lens and often misinterpreting it, not understanding the context that these people were operating within. And that's what fascinates me about gaming and why I do it.
Yeah.
So
now I completely understand there are other people who simply couldn't care about that.
Yeah.
Doug,
you've unintentionally brought up something because last I checked, you could see a little bit into the future, but it was occasionally hazy. But the week that this podcast is going live, we will have published an article. It's a reprint of something that I'd written a while ago that I kind of updated and have reprinted. And it's the question of what's in your collection and why. And talking about, look, we've all got a stack of war games we haven't played yet. We all do. Any war gamer that says they don't isn't a real war gamer. I'm just convinced of that.
Right.
We all have a stack of stuff that we've bought and haven't yet played. And occasionally we try to convince ourselves that we're keeping it unpunched for some aesthetic reason when in fact we just haven't gotten around to it yet. But it kind of brings up the question of what do you buy? What do you read or study and what do you actually play? And, you know, one of the things, it's not a secret. We've talked about it a bunch. I have a giant stack of Cold War Goes Hot in Europe, games going on. I'm actually, as we're doing this, if you hear some clicking noises in the background, I am finishing punching out the rest of the new World at War 85 base box set. I've punched out what I've needed for the scenarios that I've played as a part of writing the review that I'm doing on it. But I figured it was time to get around to punching the rest of them out. And so I'm doing that while we're talking here. I have a ton of these things. I have read all of them. I have studied the maps. I've taken a look at sort of how they model the units. I haven't played them all. I've played a bunch of them, but I haven't played them all. I haven't played all the copies that I have. There are times that I've played other people's copies, which is why my copy of GDW's Battlefield Europe is still unpunched. I've played other people's copies, so I don't have to punch mine. But I've got a ton of those that I've read and studied, but those aren't the ones that I've played the most. And there's a lot of World War II stuff that I've played a whole lot more than the Cold War stuff that I probably own more of. And so it goes back to the question of what do you buy, what do you read or study, and which ones do you actually play? It'd be cool if those three things have a significant overlap in the Venn diagram, but let's be realistic, a lot of them probably don't. And you mentioned, you know, in your world, those Battles of the Age of Reason, you probably haven't gotten a ton of those on the table. even though they're more detailed and more in-depth than some of your Horse and Musket games. But even if you weren't the developer on Horse and Musket, you probably would have played that one more, no?
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. And in fact, I did, because if you remember, the first couple of Horse and Musket games came out, I wasn't the developer.
Yeah.
I was just, I owned the game and we played a lot of, much more so. I've got, a ton of Battles of the Age of Reason games that aren't even punched yet. Probably never will be. But I've certainly looked at all the rules. But yeah, Horse and Musket, I'm going to play a hell of a lot more because I can get a game of it done in about an hour and a half.
Well, and you're being paid to, so,
Well, there's that, too.
But, so, I mean, look, Jim, we know that, if it's got a short Corsican guy in it, you're going to buy them. Obviously, you're going to be reading the majority of those. How many of them actually hit the table for you?
Oh, gosh. I mean, and talk about the consequences of Tabletop Simulator on my gaming. I'm a miniatures gamer. I realize that. I have accepted that, and I'm moving on. And since Tabletop Simulator is surfeited, or it's not everything I want. There are yet no Neapolitan troops, although we're getting more and more. Because of that, I've got them. Napoleon's Eagles was released by Compass Games. It's a nice light card game of several Eastern battles, Friedland, Borodino, I think two or three others. I bought at the same time War and Peace, really nice. Oh, my God, it's pretty. And here's the thing. Mark McLaughlin's War and Peace is really, really it's basically War and Peace, the Avalon Hill classic, just with a ton more rule tweaks and a fixed campaign game and some glorious counters. I also bought Ty Bomba's Vagram because I wasn't not going to buy a Vagram.
Yeah.
And I got a big strategic Pits War game that Paper Wars also put out. I have read the rules to all these things. The odds that any of them hit the table in the next 6 months is a very, very small number. Because I have a roster of things and people who want to play them on Saturday Night Fights and maybe Wednesday Night Warfare, which is really my only limited time I've got, where they want to play these miniatures games with me. That's winning to me. So to answer your question, got a lot, read a lot, played about none.
Just when you're saying going to hit the table, we're including Tabletop Simulator in there, right?
With Tabletop Simulator, it's more a question of somebody just put up the Napoleonic Wars. Again, Mark McLaughlin's classic card-driven weirdo fest of the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
It's a blast. The game is a huge amount of fun. Because it can be wildly ahistorical, I don't care. I like that. I get the point. The only rule it has, the French and the British can never ally. Other than that, it's pretty much game on.
Yeah.
And so that just came out. It's more availability of pieces and parts. Mad Mark has done the Napoleon at War Quad. He has done Wellington's Victory. He has done Napoleon's Last Battles, the greatest war game ever done. He's so many of these. Somebody just put up Napoleon at Marengo, the Simmons game, as well as Napoleon's Victory, the Simmons game. So if those things are out there, yeah, I might easily get to play those because I can throw it on a virtual table and have at it the way I like to these days. But the idea that instead of playing with, let's just take Vagram on from the Napoleon's War Quad, it's set up, rules are there, my opponents are available, and I can play it till I'm done or save it, or we'll be finished, and I just click off and the game is stored. That's just from an efficiency standpoint, that's not close.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't think that has to do with rules complexity or rules components that's a convenience factor that exists regardless of the level of detail or complexity of the game. I think some of, Doug had mentioned Battles of the Age of Reason, Labatt. Like, are you ever going to set up a Labatt game in Tabletop Simulator?
Me personally, no, won't happen.
Yeah.
I won't do it because I know that my pool, because it comes down to, look, and if I've never said this, and I wonder if I have, what matters to me is I spend a very, very long time not able to play these games because, A, I hadn't made the prudential decision to have a son, and B, my friends, I have dear, dear friends who are not war gamers. And it was only later in life that I got and the war game store I cared most about, Napoleon's, closed. So I lost that. now I've got, you know, in addition to my very special group of people from the Armchair Dragoons, I've got a broader pool of 30, 40 people that'll play a game with me at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
Why am I going to, why, you know, it, yes, I study rules. They're what I have by my bedside before I go to bed. I love reading rules. I will always love reading rules. I will not stop. But when it's recreational gaming time, why would I not reach out to human beings?
Absolutely.
That's madness. We can sit around, have a blast, laugh at each other, you know, taunt each other, but basically have a wonderful time, share each other's lives, even at a remote, and play a game. I mean, that's goofy to me that I wouldn't do that. That's unimaginable to me at this point in my life, which is why, which is a whole set, which may be the subject of a rant someday, I don't get solo gaming. And I don't get marketing to solo gamers. You know, Doug was making the point earlier about John Tiller games, that they're not built for with an AI. He's right. It doesn't have much of an AI. But yet, Doug, you know, when you and I have been playtesters, we're always told the majority of our gamers, the majority of our players are playing against the AI. I'm going to say this with all respect. I adore – I'm looking at my computer desktop. They are all lined up, all the little ends. How many of them are there? Are there 17?
Something at least that, yeah. I mean,
you know, it's like I've got all my little ends. They have a special place right here on my table, on my desktop, where all the little ends are. If you're playing them against the AI, I don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like if you know, I study the map, sure. Study the units, sure. But play the game? Nobody's that stupid, you know, to have the AI give them a game. I don't understand that at all. So, no, and that just takes it a step further, because there are at least two active clubs where you can find regular opponents for these things. Go out and meet people, play with people, make friends. Shoot, I've stayed at the home of people in Britain that I met playing games, and in France, and it, just go out there, sorry.
Go on, you were on a rant, like...
You are this idea that work. It's bizarre to me that people think they're alone. I have to play solo games. No, you don't.
Yeah, there are people who make that argument, and I've never understood.
It's so weird.
You know, I'm sitting here in Carmel, Indiana, and I can't swing a dead cat without finding war game opponents in the Indianapolis area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I ran across a guy a couple of years ago who we play every Thursday night. And we've continued to play during this quarantine. We've just moved it to Vassal.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's entirely possible to do. Now, I will say that I will play Tiller games solo. I won't play against the AI, but I will play them solo. But again, it goes back to, that's a lab for me, right? I am trying to see, okay, in this battle, if I do this then, right? Or I just recently went on a big rampage where I read exhaustively about the 80 Years' War.
Nice.
And particularly about the English involvement in the 80 Years' War, to the point where I was reading the actual... action accounts, the memoirs of Sir Francis Vere, his original manuscript as published in about 1613, of his experiences during the war. He was the primary English commander. And so I wanted to, okay, I want to see, how does this play out, right? Because we've got these Dutch guys who are, you know, not that well trained. It's, you know, what's the difference between before Maurice introduces his reforms and after he introduces his reforms? What do the formations look like? What do the tactics look like? And that's more of a research thing for me.
Yeah.
Right? But I've got a game engine that'll allow me to simulate that. So I will play them solo, but not from the perspective of I don't have anybody to play with.
Right.
Right? I mean, I could have at any time popped up an email to you and said, hey, Jim, I want to play Renaissance. And we'd have had a game.
Yep.
Right? So, but there are times when I actually don't want another person. Because I want the other side, right? I want the sides to do specific things.
Yes.
And right? Let's face it, we all know at least one person out there for whom, if the option is playing with them or playing solo, we'll go play solo.
Oh, that's true, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's be clear here.
We know those guys. And they're the ones that we try to actively keep away from anybody else we want to be a wargamer. So
yeah, no, it's I've told these stories. I'll be just real quick. You go to Historicon, you're going to meet 80% of the people that are you. They're the best. They love this hobby. They love history. They study it probably. It always is. They seem to study it harder than you do. I think my problem is I have no attention span, right? I won't study just one thing. Like the guys in the Civil War Roundtable, forget about it, you know. But there's always 20% that are like, are you really trying to validate your self-worth by being here?
Yeah.
This is not the choice I would have made.
There's a couple of designers like that, too. Fortunately, one of the most insufferable has been thrown off of Facebook, and we don't have to deal with him anymore. So,
true story.
Yeah.
One of the nicest guys I know in gaming, other than Doug, just was out at Historicon. Now, I've known him for years. We have played games at Historicon. Ex-Marine, one of the most soft-spoken, nicest guys you ever want to meet, completely plays against the stereotype of the jarhead, right? We were playing, I decided I bought a ticket for Force on Force, the modern minis game. We're playing this, and the guy playing in this game, he wasn't the GM, but I was there, I was playing with my buddy, this guy, as well as the son of the guy who is now responsible for Shaco 2, who I know through that. So it's the three of us, and we are having a blast. You know, I get blown up by an IED and I'm upset and all this. Yeah, whatever. We're just playing a game. This other guy sitting across the table is giving the stuff to this Marine. A whole game. And we're looking at him like, what are you doing? Oh, you're doing that wrong. Oh, you shouldn't do that. Oh, you shouldn't do this. Oh, you shouldn't do that. And finally, me and the kid from the kid was, he's not a kid now, he's in his 20s. The guy who's the son of the guy who does Shaco, we just looked at each other and went, dude, we're out because you're just being a jackass and we're going to walk away.
Right.
And we're just walk away. The guy that was giving the grief to this other dude who should have punched him in the face, it was that bad, was the guy who designed Force on Force.
Yeah.
And I went, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We're playing your game?
Right.
We're playing your game that you're trying, I would think you would want to promote as a fun, light, merry experience that teaches things, and you act like this? So yeah, we laughed about that for a day and a half.
Yeah, we all know somebody like that in the gaming world.
Well, and unfortunately, there are designers and developers who are doing this for reasons other than providing the public with an enjoyable experience. You know, I can't say it any other way, right? It's a massive, hey, look how smart I am kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm a game designer. Well, you know, look, man, I've now been involved in game design and development long enough to know that if you are looking for a way to not be rich,
yeah,
this is way close to the top of the stack, right? I mean, it is. This is a hobby and a labor of love. There are very few people who are going to make a bunch of money, particularly off of designing war games.
I also contend that the fact that I am legitimately considered to be a game designer shows what a very low bar to intellectual entry there is into this field. It's one of those, look, I know what it takes to be a published game designer. I know what it takes to be a game designer in a professional sense and in an academic sense. You're not impressing me by telling me that you're a game designer because I know where I am on the intellectual spectrum. And if you want to come down to my level, cool. Like, I got no problem with it. But if you're trying to use that as the level with which to elevate yourself, like, we got issues, folks. I mean,
right.
So,
yeah, I mean, seriously, it's sort of amazing that people tie so much self-worth to it. But, you know, be that as it may, I think we are in a time, and this is, here, let me poke the bear again. But, you know, we've had this discussion so many times about the hobby dying and all the rest of this. Well, you know, it may be that we've had a really interesting and fortuitous collision of events here where we're all locked up at a time when we have tools that we've never had before.
Yeah, true.
That is actually going to be really good for the hobby because people are home, they've got to do something, and they're rediscovering gaming and rediscovering board gaming as a thing they can do while they're in isolation.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how many of them stick with it after this.
Right.
Sorry, Bob, I cut you off there.
No, you can say you're perhaps discovering aspects of the hobby which weren't obvious before.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's the case, that there are people that are didn't really think about it, didn't really see it as a thing, and, you know, to kind of go back to something Jim and I have said many times in the past, I'm playing games. You guys that golf, what are you doing?
Well, golfers are golfing because you can do that and stay 6 feet away from everybody else. It's the guys playing basketball that have an issue.
Not here, they're not, because the mayor closed down all the golf courses.
Oh, no, they're open here. I do think it's a good thing that folks have had a chance to play, and I think it's shown the resiliency of our hobby, that it's one of those, you know, to go back to a Marine quote, adapt, improvise, and overcome. Like, gamers want a game, we're going to figure out a way to game, and, you know, if we got to sit 6 feet apart from our computers to do that, then we will. But yeah. But the gamers are going to game somehow, some way. We'll find a way to do it. We were doing, Jim and I have made frequent note of the advertisements in old Dragon magazines when we were doing those things before, that there was, you know, we were doing play by mail back before the E was in PBEM. We were doing play by mail of fantasy adventures, of big combat games. There's been play-by-mail diplomacy since the game came out. And so it's gamers are going to adapt, improvise, and overcome and figure out a way to play the game somehow. And so, you know, Doug, you go back to why would you ever play a game solo? They're you know, again, adapt, improvise, and overcome. Maybe that's the only way some folks can get a game in somehow. I've got a couple. The States of Siege games from Victory Point are actually fun little games. There's not a good way to play those other than solo. They've been fun games. I've enjoyed playing those over the years. Empires of America especially, I really dig that one, which is way outside my usual historical periods of what I enjoy. But I've enjoyed the hell out of that game. That's a solo game. But sometimes I've got an hour and a half to kill. I'm not booting up Civ on my laptop. I'm going to throw Empires of America on the table and just have fun playing a solo game of that. It's... You know, there's no reason not to if you've got the chance and you don't have a good way to connect with somebody else to do something. Yeah. And
Brent, did you ever get under an iron sky?
I did not. Mo and I actually talked about that on last week's podcast, that it was one of those ones that it is completely in my wheelhouse and it's something that I should have like four copies of. But it when it released... First of all, the cost was insane. $220 or whatever it was in U.S. dollars was insane. But it also happened to hit at a time when I was between jobs. And $220 is 3 weeks worth of groceries. So there was no chance of that happening at the time. Now there's word of a possible reprint. Thin Red Lines has put out a survey trying to gauge interest and a possible pre-order for a reprint of that. And I did say, yeah, I would be interested in that. I don't know that, as Mo and I talked about on the podcast last week, I don't know that there's any chance I will ever get that game to a table other than at a convention. And I'm saying this as a dude that has a separate room in his house where I can set up a game and leave it out with no fear of kids or pets or anything else happening to it. I've got a space to do it, and I'm still not sure I would. Part of that is opponents. Part of that is time. You know, look, we've all seen the component list from Under an Iron Sky. It takes you 3 weeks to punch the damn thing. as cool as it would be to play, I just don't know. If I had an opportunity to play in it, sure. But I don't know about buying it, owning it, setting it up, you know, the care and feeding of the game that it would take to actually play it. I would more than happily volunteer to go to somebody else's house and play it once a week for a month and a half. But I don't know that I want to be the house that happens at.
No.
So, and then Deadly Northern Lights is it Deadly Northern Lights? Is that what it's called? That just released from the same guys. It's the same scale and everything ties in with Under an Iron Sky. It's the Northern Front. It's Scandinavia.
All right.
Same thing. Looks awesome. And the cool thing about Scandinavia is we all know where the key terrain in Central Europe is. We've gamed and studied this to death. We know which highways you need to get through Bavaria. We know that the Lüneburger Heath is actually more important than the Fulda Gap. Like, we all got this down.
But, we know where to look on the map for the Fulda Gap.
Yeah, but you know, exactly how do you get to you know, Uppsala? How important is Malmo? You know, is where do you really need to make your approach to Oslo? Like, I don't know. You know, do you bypass Helsinki? Do you siege Helsinki? Do you bomb the shit out of Helsinki? Like, I don't know. I mean, that would be a really interesting set of challenges on a map that I don't know that well and would be interesting to see. You know, again, going back to those conversations we had last week on the podcast, man, that's just such a high bar to entry for being able to play that thing. I mean, even a tabletop simulator, I mean, if you've got to, like, scroll three times to get across the table, that's a lot, man. I mean, it's just, they're so massive. Oh. When I lived in Columbus, I used to marvel at the dudes that were playing the OCS stuff at CABS. I mean, they were playtesting. So this was going back, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago when I lived in Columbus. They were playtesting the 44, 45, like Beyond the Rhine, I think is what it's called. Whatever the OCS game is.
Yes.
That covers from Paris to the surrender of Germany. They were playtesting that one, and they played that game end to end three different times. They played it once. They made some rules tweaks with the designer and everything. They changed sides. They played it again, and then they played it a third time with the actual production components. And it would take them months of playing several hours every other Friday night to play these things to completion. And I was always impressed at how, at the scale of what they were doing, and it was never something that I just really wanted to sit down and be a part of. So, going back to what Doug was talking about earlier, you know, what do you study versus what are you going to play? I think the OCS games lend themselves well to study. It's just...
Yeah, they do.
How Gary plays in two of those a week, I have no idea.
And they're particularly good. I mean, one of the things about that series is that it's done a really nice job at modeling logistics.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you're interested in that kind of thing, then it's really worth taking a look at that.
Yeah.
Right?
But
depending on what you mean by play, right?
Yep.
You might really be studying it, but just calling it play. So yeah, there's a lot of worth in those kind of systems. It's just, you know, there are people who would look at what somebody like Gary does with those games and go, God, that's like, you know, watching paint dry. Hey, different strokes for different folks, right?
Yeah. I am in no way disparaging the fact that they enjoy the hell out of playing. I am totally down with that. You know, as Jim has said, if that's your thing, go get your groove on. I am totally down with it. It's not something I want to play. But right. That doesn't mean I got any problem with somebody else playing it.
I'm going to blame you guys. I got to tell you that from where we started, this conversation, I went and said, you know what, man, I got Steel Panthers MBT. I paid for that from Shrapnel. So while we were talking, I installed it, updated it, got it all. There's the rest of my weekend.
It's fine. I'll take the blame for it. If it's my fault that I caused you to game more, you know, I can live with that.
Well, and interestingly, it's really the first war game that I've played in about 3 weeks. I've been playing more. I haven't been able to deal with anything that was either too real world or required me to actually think too deeply. So I've been playing a lot of Warhammer 40K computer game stuff.
I saw you.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say you were playing coin games.
Yeah, no, that would never happen with me. But
it's just escapism, you know, Doug.
That's exactly what it is, but I'm fine with that. I'm completely fine with that.
Yep. So as we are recording, we're hitting the 90-minute mark, which is totally cool. This is going to be a longer podcast because, let's face it, we're all locked in by the plague and we don't mind talking games with each other. We're hoping the audience doesn't mind listening to us talking games with each other.
They've got nothing better to do. You know?
Yeah. I suppose if they did, they wouldn't have made it to the 90-minute mark where we're talking about this. So.
Exactly.
And by the time I edit this down, this will probably be about the 122 mark or so once we edit out some of the laughter and a few flubs here and there, but it's been great talking with you guys. Bob, love having you on the call. It's just, you know, you and your damn time zones make it so tough to be able to get you on here sometimes.
Sorry.
So a question then, not tabletop simulator, but actual tabletop, on the table. Bob, what's the next game you think you're going to get laid out on a table, physical components, pushing things around?
Well, at the minute, it's the Spanish Civil War from GMT, which is an operational level game. But I've been looking very closely to a game which I know Doug's got but hasn't played yet, which is one of my most interesting battles from the American Civil War, which is Antietam. Worthington Games have just brought out a new game for it, which unfortunately hasn't made it to the UK yet. But I've been reading the rules for that, and I'm really interested in that. That could be my next purchase. Possible. For the minute, yes, it's the Spanish Civil War. And I've been messing about a lot with Horse and Muskets still, which I've been doing on Vassal. So that's my little gaming corner.
Doug, what's the next physical copy of something going to hit the table?
Almost certainly Horse Kit, just because I've got work to do.
I was going to say, so that's work. Anything different for fun?
In terms of fun, I'm right in the middle of a game. We're playing some of the Musket and Pike series stuff. I'm right in the middle of a game of Edge Hill with David Van Hoos. And we'll probably play a ton of that stuff the rest of the year. I did realize when Bob asked me the other day about Antietam that not only do I have Antietam, the new Worthington game, but I also have
the
Shiloh game, neither of which have been punched. And then I actually the other day brought my Clippers up because I have a copy of a game called The Fate of Readers, which is a Hexasim game. Of the Shot, Shock, and Faith games series. These are about the French Wars of Religion in the mid to late 1500s.
Doug, is this the follow-on game for the same system by Shot, Shock, and Faith?
Yep, it's exactly that. And so I need to punch that, and I'd really like to play that. In fact, I may talked with my wife earlier today about, hey, if you want to play a game, so I may try and co-op my wife into give it a try.
It's a nice system. It's a really nice system.
It really is, and given its area movement and combat stuff, it's a little bit easier for somebody that's a non-war gamer to get their head around.
Yeah.
I think Jim is still tied up with his emergency work call, so we're not going to have him to ask. As we are recording this, Saturday Night Fights is claiming that they'll try to finish the Battle of Friedland tonight. I wouldn't put money on it. This is going into week three. Lord knows how long this is actually going to take. I've got World at War 85 on the table next to me, and not just because I was punching out counters, but because I'm still playing this one, going on my third or fourth different scenario. All the ones that I've played at least twice, but I'm going on my third or fourth different scenario now. I really enjoy the game, which sort of tells you what's coming in the review, right? But I really enjoy the game, so I'm having fun poking around with it some. But after this, one of the things that I'm wanting to do that, you know, look, we're all locked in, so we've all got some time to kill here. I had a conversation about a week and a half ago. There was a guy that's doing some university level research on game designers and sort of game design processes and stuff that I've been a part of this cohort for several years now where he comes back and re-interviews us every year or so. And one of the reasons he wanted to talk to me is I've done both professional and commercial stuff, but it got me to thinking all the completely unfinished designs that I've got laying around and I've got bad enough ADD as it is that Orange Crush has never gotten fully finished. It's pretty close, but it hasn't gotten over that last 10% hump. But after I got off the call with him, I was looking at, you know, my back burner folder of different design stuff sitting on the computer here. I'm like, holy crap, I've got a lot of stuff laying around. And so the question is, can I actually get one of them finished? And I'm not betting on it. There's not a chance in hell I think I'm actually going to do it. But I'm wondering if I shouldn't at least make a good faith effort to try and finish at least one of these things. And
we'll be checking up on you.
Yeah. Hold your breath for that. But, you know, maybe just put them out there as free print and play kind of things or something. But I was just going through going, God, I got a lot of crap laying around that's just almost done. And so after...
So you know what you need to do?
Hire some developers?
Yeah, we'll get BC and so, rope him into doing the development.
So you want me to get the guy who's notorious for not finishing things to supposedly help the guy who can't finish things?
Well, he's no good at reviews, but...
He can review the hell out of some stuff, but... How many AARs has that dude actually played to completion over the years?
Yeah, that's true.
It might not be your best idea ever, that, Doug, I'm afraid.
Well, that was my effort to not volunteer to do it.
No,
I wasn't trying to volunteer you, Doug. Doug, a couple of these are Hanseatic weed orgies. They are not up your alley.
Mission accomplished.
Just for the record. Doug has, I think that's a military classification, the ability to not volunteer.
Right, exactly.
It's an MOS identifier.
This is service ribbon.
Yeah. It's actually a required skill test to be promoted to E4.
Oh, very good.
That I believe, yep.
There's a reason they call him the E4 Mafia, so.
He is very good at not volunteering.
Yeah. Well, Jim, since you are back, you get to answer the question, what is the next physical game to hit the tabletop in your house? Not TTS, not digital.
Oh.
What's the next physical thing to hit the... And we're asking the guy who lives in a house full of gamers, obviously, so, you know.
Yeah, I've got... It'll be a close race. Actually, it's going to be a very slow race because of how much TTS gaming I do. But it'll be a close race. Gloomhaven is my wife's favorite. And probably Austerlitz from the same guys, Waterloo Spanish company, the Waterloo Folger, using Kriegspiele-looking wooden block.
Okay.
So do you have that?
What had happened was.
Oh boy. Do we need to refill the drinks before this story starts?
I had not gotten Waterloo, and then they put out Trafalgar with all their little ships.
Right.
I just don't need that in my life. I just don't. And then they said Austerlitz, and they refined those, and there were some great reviews, and I went, All right. I'm getting Austerlitz because it is actually one of my favorite battles and all that. And then I clicked on Austerlitz and up pops, hey, we're offering a sale if you buy this on Trafalgar and Waterloo. And so I went, it's European, the shipping alone. And I went dink, dink. So I'm getting all three as soon as they're able to ship.
I'm waiting on mine to show up. Because I bought them too.
I was like, oh, son of a.
I'm just still stunned at the fact that a Waterloo game was released and Jim didn't buy it.
I know. I was trying, but see, I failed ultimately, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I did buy it. Yeah. No, technically the money's gone. I've paid for it. Let's be clear. I have shelled out the fund. It's because of the situation we're all in. But no, I had a situation where I tried to show restraint. I said, I'm not getting this one too. And then I looked at it and went, no, it's very much of a piece with what our buddy Marshall is doing.
Right.
You know, it's all that. Wait a minute. We can move all Kriegspiele or miniatures like, well, miniatures gaming is all a derivation of the spiel. Okay. Stop it. You know, and, it was Dr. Patty Griffith who said, I love miniatures as art. I love them as craft. But whoever it was that fetishized 25mm lead blocks and said this is the only way to wargame just got it wrong, you know. And so now instead we can blocks around and it's just as good. So yeah, it's an exciting system. I'm really looking forward to getting it. I'm not quite as sure about the Trafalgar one, but I wasn't gonna live without that either.
I know we're trying to wrap up here, but I gotta ask, Jim, did you jump on the Kickstarter for this Marengo 1800 Napoleonic Tactical War?
You sent me that. You sent me that on Twitter, and I'm sorry I didn't respond.
The one that comes in a tube.
Doug and I sat down. We're pretty sure we sat down with that guy.
Yeah.
At Orange, what about to go, Doug?
Right.
Was it? I'm going to say something. I'm going to say something that I can't believe is about to emerge from my mouth.
You're going to say the same thing I was going to say.
I'm entering it's Missouri, right? The Show Me State.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're going to have to show me because this really feels, and I want to be wrong, I want it to be awesome because all Napoleonic games, awesome. But it feels like fiddle for its own. Yeah. Like fiddle, just because fiddle somehow makes it more authentic.
Yeah.
Sam Mustafa and Blücher, particularly, because that's what I know best, is an example of clean it up.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
The TTS crew always managed to screw things up. And when I say we, I mean myself. And that's why our buddy Hasdrubal is such a great resource, because he's always going, no, it doesn't work that way. But if you read the rules and really remember them, they are and straightforward. They say what they mean. I'm so worried with the digits and the widgets and the blocks and the tchotchkes that it's too darn much.
Yeah.
And I felt that when Doug and I sat down with him with a prototype at Origins, if it's the same fella. And it certainly reads that way here. The greatest Marengo game of all time is Bonaparte at Marengo by Simmons, the Simmons game. And it couldn't be cleaner.
Yeah.
Similarly, our guy, we should always put in a plug for Marshall. And it is Command Post Games, right, Doug?
Correct.
Command, you know, a beautiful, beautiful map. Couldn't be more gorgeous. Wooden blocks and four pages of rules. And it's a blast. There's something to be said for that. And if you're gonna make it up with toys and things, I of course I'm going to follow it. Of course I'm going to study it. I hope it is a tremendous success. But nope, not in yet.
Well, the Kickstarter's ended as we are recording this. There are videos on there sort of showing the gameplay. It's Napoleonic. It's not something I'm going to jump on, but I didn't know if you had.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, it's not grabbing me.
Yeah.
Which is really for the two of us is like, should probably buy this, right? We're like obligated. Oh.
Well,
it just isn't it.
It jumped out at me because of the significantly different form factor compared to many of the war games that we are used to, with the rotating base, the pegs that are tracking information in there, the map is a thing of beauty. I think the map is absolutely gorgeous. But
I agree.
But you know, do you want to deal with a bad game for a good map?
And like I say, I mean, if you go to Command Post Games and look at their pub battles, yeah, they're not cheap, but there's a reason they're not cheap. Those maps are spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, guys, my daughter's now knocked on the office door twice wondering when I'm going to wrap this up. So I think we need to wrap this up. Jim, we will watch some Tabletop Simulator tonight and every Saturday night on the Saturday Night Fights, socially distant before it was cool. And
I'm in.
Doug, are you in the game tonight, or are you just doing other stuff?
Well, they're so far along, unless there's, you know, a problem with somebody that's been playing, I probably won't. If he's got a hole that, you know, somebody needs to plug in at the last minute.
I think you should show up with some of the Martian tripods from War of the Worlds and just get the game over with now that we're going into week three here.
I can tell you that the problem with Friedland, Jim and I playtest Lind War, the Tiller game that covers it.
Yes, we did.
And we played that battle for, mm-hmm. It's a long battle. There's a lot that goes on there. So the fact that they're even as close as they are to wrapping that up in the time span is a testament to it's been moving along, and that rule set is a pretty clean rule set because, man, did we play Friedland for a long time.
Yeah,
and I want to be very clear. It was an absolute blast. I loved
it. Oh, yeah.
You know, it was a great, great game. Matter of fact, if you have a chance to play the John Tiller Friedland game, know that Doug and I put our stamp of approval on it. We loved it. But by the same token, yeah, it's because one of the things that makes it fun is that, you know, the Russians start out with this huge advantage and then this massive French surge on the field and who, you know, will one break before the other. It's great stuff.
All right, Bob needs to go get some porridge and warm milk before bedtime here because of how late it is for him.
And it's not that late.
Yeah, but
yes,
don't folks your age go to bed at like 6 p.m. or something?
I am getting some funny looks from the missus. Yes, are you coming up for something to eat or not?
Well, we need to wrap up before she starts brandishing the frying pan, so... Guys, this has been fun. Bob's, you know, once a season podcast appearance. Doug, thank you for jumping on with Bob. Not that it's hard to get you to come talk games with Bob. And Jim, thank you for hopping on at the last minute. And we shall talk to everyone again in the future shortly. Thank you guys very much. Thank you, audience, for sticking with us. and joining us on Mention and Dispatches. We do need to shamelessly beg for a couple of iTunes ratings here and there. Just trying to get enough ratings to appear on our podcast so that we start showing up in the recommendation engines. So if you got a chance, you can go throw us a couple of stars over on iTunes. Just any old rating will do. We hope it's a good one, but we'll take whatever we can get, just enough ratings that we start showing up as recommendations. So
very good.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us on Mention and Dispatches, and we'll talk to you next week.
See you guys later.
Thanks, all.
Take care, everyone.